Good afternoon.
I appreciate the one of you. I won't call names. Got a plate of food from the meeting next door and brought it in here. Taking it back helps the image of lawyers. This will be a fun hour and a half, 2 hours, and thank you for coming today. I hope that besides the CLE that you'll gain, that you'll find it to be informative. It will be of great use to the State Bar of Texas as we listen to questions and comments that you might have. A little housekeeping matters. You should have at least two or three pieces of paper that you had a chance to pick up. One, our speaker on the overview of the rules, Tom Watkins, he has a handout. It'll be on the screen also. We'll go through at least all of this handout and probably some more. There's a second piece of paper. There's a single piece of paper that says texasbar.com/ethics, a new site on the State Bar that gathers all of the legal ethic resources in the state of Texas as it relates to lawyers and judges. That's a place where you can use that as an entry spot to look up a blog on this process. And otherwise look at redline versions and drafts and things like that. Some of you were given green cards. I hope you make use of those green cards today. After about 30 minutes of an overview, then the room switches from someone up here speaking about the rules to hopefully you being willing to tell us what your concerns, comments, questions are. The way we'll do that is we'll collect the green cards if you'd like to speak. There is a microphone in the middle aisle. We would ask you to speak there. It's being recorded. I want to let you know that for sure, because every day after we do one of these meetings in a different city, we're taking the whole session and downloading it to the State Bar website, so you can listen to any of the nine cities and hear what happens there. In addition to listen to the entire transcript of the proceeding, we have a summary that goes up overnight about what happened in that city before. And then, of course, at this ethics/ethics website, there's a place where you can blog, where you can come in and comment and follow the comments that are happening by public and lawyers on this process and the proposed amendments. If none of those are ways that you want to give comment, you can always email us. The collection point for those emails at the State Bar is through a gentleman named Ray Cantu, who's here today. But Ray's email address is rcantu@texasbar.com, rcantu, C-A-N-T-U, at texasbar.com. And then the old-fashioned way works. You're going to pick up the phone, you're going to corner somebody, you want to send a letter, that works just fine too. But we're taking all that information real time and trying to get it back up within 24 hours and make all this available as we go through the discussion of the proposed amendments. This is not the final deal. As you may know, this has been a long process. A thumbnail history includes the ABA coming out with some model rules of ethics, disciplinary rules in 2002, the Supreme Court of Texas in 2003 appointing a task force to look at the ABA model rules and give comments on those. Tom was the chair of the Supreme Court's task force on these rules. The State Bar has a standing committee on the disciplinary rules. It also started work in looking at these rules. Those two groups, and many, and I see Alan just looking at me right now, and Connie's here also, and I'm going to give everybody that has worked on these rules a chance here in a minute, with Pat, the current chair of the State Bar Standing Committee on Disciplinary Rules. Those two groups then have a conference committee on their differing ideas about these rules. All that was delivered to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has worked through those. Last October, the Supreme Court came out with draft number one of the proposed amendments and said, Texas, you have 60 days to give comments. In those 60 days, November and December of last year, 09, they received over 400 discrete comments on particular rules. The Supreme Court took those 400-plus comments and worked through them this spring, coming out with draft number two in the middle of April. That's the draft that's out right now. And after that draft was done, it had been worked on all along the way, the comments came out this summer in July of 10. And then the Supreme Court sent us a letter and said, State Bar, Board of Directors, we would like your comments and recommendations on these proposed amendments. Please do that no later than October 6th. We will have a meeting on Friday, October 1st, to vote on comments and what our reply is to the Supreme Court. And then we will wait on the Supreme Court to hear what they do next. It's possible that they will still change rules based on everything that's still happening. It's possible that they would ask that there be a referendum of the Texas lawyers to vote on whether or not we will accept rules. The ballot, whether you vote them all up or all down, or whether you do one rule at a time or group them in some fashion, would have to be a part of their order. We don't know the answer to that yet. We know that we are trying to be sure that everyone has a chance in today's world, whether it be all the different ways I outlined earlier, to know about these rules and to have a chance to comment and give questions. After Terry gives 30 minutes, we'll switch over. I'm going to have Ray will be a timer sitting close to the speaker to let you know you have a five-minute countdown. We want to start off asking everybody to speak or ask their question within 5 minutes so we be sure we cover the room. If it's a question, we'll call on a resource person in the room to try to answer that. If it's a comment, it's going to be noted and, of course, be passed on as a part of the record we are giving to the Supreme Court all the while. And then if we get to where there's nobody else that wants to speak in front of the microphone officially with a green card, then we turn the room open to discussion and just let, in a more informal fashion, let you ask a question of anybody you want to or a comment on anything you want to in a more informal way than having to go to the microphone. That's worked well in some other cities. We'll see how it does here. And I would like to let you know that the blue suits to my right are your representatives from the Houston area on the State Bar Board. Tom Watkins is to my immediate right, and he'll stand up in just a second. But I want to give let you see who your representatives are, because they are the ones that are going to be hearing all this and then voting on Friday, October 1st. So, Warren, would you start us off and just go down and say your name and where you work?
Warren Cole, my law office, and I primarily do family law litigation.
Hi, Travis Sales with Baker Botts.
Brad Hancock, Greenberg Clark.
I'm Greg Dykeman. I'm from Beaumont. I have District 9, which starts in Montgomery County and covers most of East Texas towards Louisiana. Tom and Proctor own the office of the Greenway Plaza area and do mediation.
I'm Stuart Cagnon. I'm with Fulbright Dvorsky, and I'm a section representative to the board.
Barrett Reasoner. I'm with Gibbs and Bruns here in Houston.
And we also have some resource folks that could help us along the way. I want you to know Kenan Peterson. Kenan is a rules attorney for the Texas Supreme Court. All the rules in Texas, she's in charge of that, filters that, works with the court on that. She's been invaluable to have on these for questions and answers. And then there are some members from the State Bar Standing Committee on the Disciplinary Rules. And if you have served on that committee during this process or currently serving, why don't you stand up at one at a time and identify yourself. And Alan, would you start us off that?
Alan Dan Fleet with Greenberg Trowering here in Houston.
Pat Chamblin with Mahaffey Weber in Beaumont.
Greg Hastley with Aiken Gunn in Houston.
Jim. I'm Jimmy Brill, and I was on the committee for a while. I'm a solo practitioner here in Houston.
Connie Acosta. And I'm practicing private
reading. Good. Thank you so much for being here. So we have lots of folks that have lots of time, but with this and with no further introduction, the chair of the task force, Tom Watkins. Yes, sir.
If you'll give me a minute, I have to delete some things I was going to say. I was going to claim what a good practitioner of the law I am, but Chuck Herring is here, and he knows how I really practice law, so I got to get rid of that stuff. And then I was going to talk about how to handle the disadvantaged or the incompetent client, and Jimmy Brill's here, so I'm not going to bring that subject up. So we're going to eliminate some of the things where I recognize that people know a whole lot about it. This process started some time ago when a member of the Supreme Court called me up and said, we're going to appoint a task force to work on the DRs and we'd like you to be chair. Well, I just puffed up like a toad. I thought that was just really great and wonderful. It wasn't until 5 years later I figured out that that's the way a Republican Supreme Court punishes a Democrat, is to make them have to go through all the disciplinary rules. And I'm not going to answer the phone if they call again. What we've got here is a circle. And in that are three slices. Those three slices represent the different interests that put pressure on every word that's in the disciplinary rules. In other words, every word you change from the old ones to the new one is going to change the way that this pie is split up. Lots of folks think that there are things in the current rules which cause lawyers to get in trouble for technical violations, which should not happen because nobody got hurt. Lots of folks think that there needs to be better protection for the lawyers in the disciplinary rules. My experience with that is that it's true in some sense. After being on the Board of Disciplinary Appeals and a grievance committee locally, I've read over 4,000 grievances. 4,000 grievances. What possessed me? And when I got through doing that, I was terribly angry at all lawyers because lawyers do some really rotten things, really rotten things. My favorite one is we disbarred a lawyer in Austin one time who was passing, he was giving cocaine to ambulance drivers so that he would pass out his card at the scene of accidents. Now, that's evil on so many levels, it just sort of takes your breath away. And if you learn nothing else today, remember, if you're in Austin and an ambulance stops to pick you up from a wreck and somebody gives you a lawyer's card, walk to the hospital, don't stay in the ambulance. There's some driving problems from that point forward. And I also was sick and tired of frivolous grievances filed again and again and again against lawyers. And I was very angry with the public. And so if you quit with that kind of volunteer work and you're angry with all the lawyers and you're angry with all the public, there's not very many places you can go. So I came off of that knowing that there are people who think and push hard and believe righteously that there needs to be better protection for the lawyers in the DR. Lots of people think there needs to be better protection for the public, that there's some things in there that lawyers can get away with the DRs as the way they are, that ought not to be and there needs to be reform. And the third thing is we are living in a different time in which the ABA has their model rules, and some people think that because of interstate practice, that what's ethical in Texas ought to be ethical in Colorado and ethical in California, and that there ought to be some uniformity. You know, like what's in Texas ought to be ethical, what's ethical in Louisiana ought to be not Louisiana. What's ethical in both of these states ought to be that you can go from one state to the other and have some idea that the same conduct would be treated the same way. So anytime anybody wants to argue about a particular word or how to change it or add to it or detract from it, they need to think about what it is they're trying to do when they change the words. Are we trying to move the center of that to where we protect the lawyers more, or are we trying to move it to where we protect the public more, or are we trying to aim towards uniformity? It only took about two meetings of the task force for me to recognize that we are Texas by God, and we're not going to do everything the ABA does, and we ran into that pretty strongly. So there are lots of things in this that are not the same as the ABA. And far as the members on my task force are concerned, we're not going to do that. They were pretty strong about that. All right, let's start with fees. First, the concept is that anybody that thinks that 104 worked the way it was hasn't been in either a legal malpractice case involving trying to figure out what the devil an unconscionable fee is, or ever tried to prosecute a grievance or defend a grievance. It was based upon unconscionable. Unconscionable was simply a strange word. Nobody else used it. And it came out of a feeling that there ought to be a level of fee dispute that might result in just fee dispute, a level of fee dispute that might result in a malpractice case for charging too much money, and then there ought to be something to put your license at risk for charging that kind of fee. And so it was kind of a three-level approach, and unconscionable was the one that was chosen for grievances. Listen to the words, unconscionable fee. A fee is unconscionable if a competent lawyer could not form a reasonable belief that it's a reasonable fee. So that word, there's no bright line there. It just doesn't work very well. Now, this one doesn't work very well either, but it's better. It now says the lawyer shall not enter an arrangement for charge or collect an illegal or clearly excessive fee. We replaced the unconscionable concept with clearly excessive. Now, if he is clearly accepting when, after a review of the facts, a reasonable lawyer would be left with a firm belief or conviction that the fee is in excess of a reasonable fee. Now, theoretically, that's a little different from just what a reasonable fee is. A clearly excessive fee is different from a reasonable fee, but it's not an unconscionable fee. It's an attempt to lower the bar some. You can say, well, there's no white line. How are you going to tell? We're going to have to find out what that means. And yes, that's true. We're going to have to find out what that means. But we've been trying to find out what unconscionable means for all these years, and we don't know what that means, really. And so I think this lowers the bar somewhat for a client and for a grievance committee to try to call a lawyer to task for charging an excessive fee. And that was a compromise. The fight fought pretty much about what the bar ought to be in terms of a grievance related to fee. Now, the next one, and I want you to look at the first two words there, the scope. This is to protect lawyers if we'll learn to do it. The best protection against a legal malpractice case and the best protection against a grievance is a good fee letter, which puts in it the scope of the representation. That is, you put down in writing with the client what it is you're going to do. The scope of the representation and the basis of the rate of the fees and expenses shall be communicated to the client before or within a reasonable time after commencing the representation, except when the lawyer will charge a regularly represented client on the same basis or rate. Any change in the basis or rate of the fee or expense shall be communicated to the client. Now, the two concepts there are make sure that the scope is in the engagement letter, and then secondly, we have a problem that reoccurs now in which you put a rate and a fee, we're going to charge you X number of dollars per hour, and then you're in a large firm, and every year there's an automatically increase in the rate across the board. And that wasn't in the fee letter, and you probably can't do that to the client if it wasn't in the fee letter up front without a new negotiation, and now you're negotiating with your own client, and we'll deal with those problems in a minute. So the idea is that if you're going to put anything in there, the rate ought to be in there, what the expenses are going to be in there, and there ought to be something about if there's a possibility that rates will go up, we'll only raise your rate if we raise everybody else's rate, or whatever the deal is that you want to make with them. But the point is you got to do it up front, and you shouldn't walk into one of these deals where the client gets an increase in rates and it's not in the fee letter and the client didn't know it was going to happen. So that's one of the things that we're trying to get people to do up front. A little random line about expenses, by the way. Management programs used to say, you know, make your copier a profit center. Don't make your copier a profit center. Anything that says we're going to charge you for expenses, then it better be expenses. If it costs you 8 cents a copy and you're charging 25 cents a copy and you ever get sued for malpractice and get cross-examined about that, juries eat that stuff up. They don't like it. You told them it was going to be an expense and it turns out you're making money off of them. It's no problem about charging 25 cents a copy or a dollar paid for fax or whatever the rate is, provided you put it in the fee agreement at the beginning so that it's an explanation of this is what I'm going to charge you. But if you just have the clause in there which says you're going to pay expenses, it better be an expense. It better not be an attempt to make profits. State that the litigation or other expenses to be deducted from the recovery and whether or not its expenses are being deducted before or after the contingent fee is calculated. Number of grievances that I saw, firstly, where the fight was whether or not the expenses came before or after the contingent fee, it still happens, and we need to make sure that we improve our practice that. And then inform the client of the litigation and other expenses for which the client will be liable, whether or not the client is the prevailing party. That needs to be done at the time of the engagement, and that's why it's in the DR that way. If you wait till after the case is lost and then decide what the client's going to have to pay for it, people get into a lot of trouble. We've had some fairly notorious cases recently from well-known plaintiff's lawyers who put in a little additional administrative fee in order to handle the case, and that needs to be stopped. And so you need to have a clear understanding about what the contingent fee is, what the expenses are, and when they're going to be charged, and who's going to pay if the thing goes south. All right, let's go to 105. If any of you are having trouble sleeping, I recommend that you take 105, put it beside your bed, and try to read it from beginning to end. My attention span at this age is such that I can't read 105 all the way from the beginning to end. The old 105 has two kinds of confidential information. It's got privileged confidential information and non-privileged confidential information. Privileged confidential information is that is defined by the rules of evidence. Non-privileged is everything else you learn as a result of the representation. Everything else you learn as a result of the representation. And that means that if your client has been indicted for embezzlement, and it's on the front page that your client has been indicted for embezzlement, if you learn about it from your client, you can't. It's confidential information, and the lawyer and the client has a right to keep you from doing certain things. The way 105 reads now is privileged confidential information. There's some things you can't do, there's some things you may do, and there's some things you have to do. Then it goes to non-privileged confidential information. Some things you can do, some things you can't do, may do, and then should do. Now we've done away with that. 105 will no longer make the distinction. Now, privileged information will still be created by the rules of evidence, and you'll have all the attorney-client privilege problems we've got now. We certainly couldn't want to do away with any of those. But there's no distinction in 105. The idea there is that we're going to be able to go through and look at it and see what you can do, and you'll notice, I guess the regular fountain pen won't do any good. In the case of a client or a former client, it's all information relating to the representation of the client from whatever source, whether acquired by the lawyer personally or through an agent or other than information that is or become generally known and is readily obtainable from sources generally available to the public. I call that the Luke Soles rule because every year for the last 10 years, he's called me up and bitched at me about the fact that this is way too broad into the current 105. We need to have, particularly in this age when the Internet is there and there's still much stuff out there, we need to have it. And if everybody knows about it, the lawyer is not going to be liable because he talked about it. That, of course, raises the question, well, what is readily known to the public? We will figure that out, and I promise you that by the time we figure it out, the technology will have changed so much that what we figure out is going to be difficult anyway. So we're going to have problems with the idea of readily known to the public, but we're going to have to deal with it. We got that same problem, by the way, in almost every rule. Technology attacks each of these rules at some level and makes us have to rethink what is the right thing for lawyers to do, and we're way ahead of ourselves in the technology. Developing disciplinary rules is kind of like knowing how to drill deep wells in the ocean but not knowing how to fix them once they go wrong. The technology gets ahead of the cure a whole lot of the time, and we're always going to be that way for DRs. There's no way we can adopt DRs that will keep up that we're not going to have to think about, well, what does this new thing do to our obligations with information and keeping it secret and all that stuff. But this, I think, is a good change, which lets us get it, and it protects the lawyers, and that was the purpose of it. When the lawyer seeks legal advice about the lawyer's compliance with these rules, you remember the Supreme Court came out recently, and if I say recently, you give or take 5 years, with a case which said that a trustee can now hire a lawyer to advise the trustee and create attorney-client privilege material between him and the lawyer that is not obligated to be given to the beneficiary of the trust. The idea was that the full disclosure and fiduciary duty problems made it difficult for the trustee to figure out how to protect himself or herself because everything that they did, the beneficiary had a right to know. The problem here is if you are a lawyer and you're worried about something that's going on with the client as to whether you should or should not do something or whether it complies or doesn't comply, you've got no ability to go to the lawyer and tell him the facts because it's confidential information and that lawyer had no right to know. At least that was an argument that a lot of people were making. So this specifically says that you can use confidential information when the lawyer seeks legal advice about the lawyer's compliance with these rules. So if you're asking an ethics question, you can divulge confidential information. It is still confidential with the lawyer that you hire to give you the advice, and you have a way to get some help with a problem if it comes up. I always put this one in because where it says the lawyer shall disclose confidential information because it's my favorite DR of all the DRs. If you look down in there, you have to report stuff, and this is the only affirmative responsibility. You have to report stuff. If you find out the client is likely to do something that will result in death or substantial bodily harm to a person, and I just love the idea of substantial bodily harm. That means if the client comes into you and says, I really hate that judge, I'm going to get her, you're obligated under the DRs to ask, well, are you going to kneecap her or are you going to kill her? Because you got to know whether it's substantial bodily harm or just regular bodily harm. And I wasn't about to let that come out because it's just so much fun to think about. And anybody that wants to fight about the fact that we have some other rules where there's no bright line and there's going to be litigation because we've changed something, remember, we have litigation about what lots of these things mean because there's no bright line in a lot of the things that we have to do, and that's just the way it has to be. There's not any way to define a bright line between substantial bodily harm and regular bodily harm. It gets more interesting when you're talking about sex. when we get to the sex relationship question to define what sex is. We can spend a lot of time on that if we want to. All right, 106. Now, 106 and 107 are the ones I call the castor oil rules. You're not going to like them. They're going to make you do some things in fee letters and engagement letters that you didn't have to do before. But the way the current DR works, people really don't think about that stuff much. And then when the whip comes down, you go and you look at the DRs, and they tell you there's some stuff you should have done back at the beginning, but it's too late to fix it. So now we're going to put in 106 and 107 as some specific things, and if you learn to practice in accordance with 106 and 107, you'll be much safer down the downside down the road. All right. A conflict of interest exists if the representation of one client will be directly adverse to another client. That's pretty much the same thing that we had before. Not quite, but pretty much. Now, the second one. There is a significant risk that the representation of one or more clients will be materially limited by the lawyer's responsibility to another client, a former client or a third person, or by a personal interest of the lawyer. You'll notice that the word substantially related is not in that. And we're going to have lots of discussion, I suspect, about whether or not substantial related should have come out, should it be put back in? What about 109, where we're talking about it there too? Why did it come out of 106 and it's not coming out of 109? And we're just going to go round and round. We're going to have lots of real honest, good faith differences of opinion about how we ought to handle this situation. But the two committees and the court, and this is compromised stuff. You got to realize my task force didn't agree with everything the State Bar Committee wanted, and they didn't agree with everything we wanted, and so then we went through this compromise process where we gave on some and took some others, and then it went to the court, and then they changed some of it too. So this has been thought through by lots of different people, and this is where it comes out. Look at the significant risk that the representation will be materially limited. That's different than just being substantially related. That means that the representation really will have an effect on the other client. Right? Now, we can argue about what that does to a prosecution, but it also, in my mind, means that there won't be as many technical violations where there was no harm as I think there exists under the current rule. That focuses on the representation of the client and not necessarily just on whether or not it's substantially related. 106 says the lawyer... we got to go back and set this up. The lawyer reasonably believes, you can take on one of these conflicts, the lawyer reasonably believes that the lawyer will be able to provide competent and diligent representation of the client, and the representation complies with 107, which we'll get to in a minute, and the client provides informed consent confirmed in writing. A couple of comments. Confirmed in writing is an attempt to try to get us somewhere closer to the current practice, and that is that's going to be okay that you send an email and then they respond back to the email that's okay. That will be part of confirmed in writing, so that we've made some attempt to make it closer to what the way practice is done lots of times. And so confirmed in writing is a special concept. Another thing that I want you to pay attention to in some of these rules, and we thought about this a long time. Lots of people feel very strongly that scienter is an interesting, is something that ought to be available as a defense in a grievance. That you ought not to get hammered for one of these just because you did something that you didn't know was wrong. They wanted there to be the concept of scienter involved in it. So you will find words in several of these rules which should reasonably should know that kind of standard in order to try to provide a defense. That's a big move in terms of trying to provide more protection to the lawyer. Everybody needs to understand that. Because there's some of them that just flat trust accounts and things like that. There's no scienter involved in that sort of thing because you dang well ought to know what's in your trust account and what's not and whether you've done that. So we went through them and decided which ones ought to have scienter and which ones they weren't. And I got to tell you, I was fighting scienter all the way along. Because I'm kind of a hard head about that. If you don't know, too bad. But I was overruled both in the task force finally and particularly by the State Bar Committee, who definitely wanted it in. So scienter will now be a part of some of these rules, and it gives more protection to the lawyer. Now, 107. The old 107, by the way, was that thing about mediating between two clients, and we threw all that away. That's no longer part of it. And this is now the new 107, and this will govern how you take in multiple clients. A lawyer shall not represent two or more clients in a matter unless One, the representation complies with 106, the one we just went through. Now, from here on out, there are a series of decisions that you have to make. Right? You have to make these judgments up front. No different than the old rule, which you had to make the judgment of whether or not it was a waivable conflict or not. And if you made the judgment that it was waivable, then you could go ask for the waiver. But you weren't allowed to even go ask for the waiver until you made a good faith judgment that it was a waivable conflict. Well, now you're going to have to decide, you reasonably believe, one, that the clients can agree among themselves to a resolution of any material issue concerning the matter. Now, that means if a couple who's getting a divorce comes into you and they want you to handle something for them, you probably ought not to take it, because if they're in the middle of a nasty divorce, you have a pretty good idea they can't reasonably agree among themselves on things, all right? If there's a material difference between the competency of one of the clients and one of the others, you have to measure the relationship between the two of them if you're going to represent both of them, and you have to decide that they can agree among themselves on a resolution of issues concerning the matter. Each client is capable of understanding what is in that interest and make informed decisions. All right? You have to decide if both clients are competent and that they can understand what you're telling them. And if you got one in there that can't understand and you're not sure and they're being totally led by the other, you better not take the case, because it's going to be a problem somewhere down the line. And by the way, the lawsuits and grievances that come out of these rules are of two kinds. They're either mom always love you best or I can't be that stupid. That's the two lawsuits that are generated by conflicts of interest. And your mom, and when they file this lawsuit about one lawyer, the lawyer preferred one client over the other, you get to be a defendant. Whichever one of them sues, the other will name the lawyer because mom always loved you best. Or there's some sort of investment going on, or there's some sort of fee dispute that comes up, and the client looks at it and you're telling them about what this stuff means in the fee agreement that they're going to have to do so-and-so, and they say, I can't be that stupid, you end up being a defendant because they don't like what you put in the fee agreement and they didn't understand it at the time they got into it. We are trying to create, then, a series of decisions that you have to decide up front. And then the lawyer can deal impartially with each of the clients. Now, think about that. You know, I'm representing ABC Oil Company, and they've been paying $1 million a year into the firm for 20 years, and now they're going to do a joint venture with the startup with a kid that's just out of college and I don't know. Can I really deal impartially between the two of them? Can I treat them the same? Can I protect each of them the same? If it comes to a conflict between the two of them, am I really going to look at the 20-year client and tell them they need to change their mind? You may need to make a decision up front as to whether or not you think you can deal impartially with the clients. Now, and the representation is unlikely to result in material prejudice to the interest of any of the clients. Now, once you've gone through that list and you've decided, And the red flags are two that I know of. There's other red flags, but the two that I know of is more than one person comes in your office at the initial interview, you need to start thinking about this. Because you've got to decide if you're going to have one client or you're going to have two clients. And you need to know that. And when you make the scope of the representation, you have to make it clear which one is the client. For transaction lawyers, if two people come in and they want to form a corporation, you're about to have three clients. And so you need to know that up front and go through this stuff about recognizing that we have to treat the to-be-named client, the corporation that gets formed, or the limited partnership, who is your client and who are you going to represent? And you have to go through these thought processes. I've testified a number of times in cases where my firm was a defendant, in which, and it always seemed to happen to us because we have a huge healthcare section, so 20 doctors get together and they want to form a group. Don't do that. Because 5 years later, they're going to come apart and they're going to sue everybody. My position has always been that the to-be-formed entity was our client. We didn't represent any of the doctors. And so I've had to testify in court that an entity that doesn't exist yet was our client, which some judges have sort of a metaphysical difficulty in dealing with that concept. But you need to make sure which one is the client, and you need to make sure that you can deal with them in regards to this. There won't be material prejudice to any of the clients that are involved. Now, once you've gone through and made that decision, then you have to make a series of disclosures. Prior to undertaking the representation, or as soon as practical thereafter, the lawyer discloses to the client that during the representation, the lawyer, one, must act impartially. Two, cannot serve as an advocate for one of them against the other. As a consequence of that, each client must be willing to make independent decisions without the lawyer's advice. Now, that means that if you talk to two people when they come in, red flags, and you decide you're going to represent both of them, and you go through that, and then as soon as they get out, one of them calls you up and says, "Now, I really need you to do this." You need to make sure that the clients understand they can't do that. They cannot ask you to do something that you don't tell the other party. So each client must be willing to make independent decision without the lawyer's advice to resolve issues that arise among the clients concerning the matter, and events might occur during the joint representation that would require the lawyer to withdraw from one or all of them. Now, that's a disclosure you have to make, because there's an economic decision about somebody hiring you in a situation in which there may become a disqualification down the line. And that economic decision needs to be part of the decision as to whether or not the client hires you. So you need to disclose that up front. Now, I recognize all I have to do is take these proposed rules and take them up to our marketing department, and they'll just chew me up one side and down the other, because this is not good marketing. Having to make these disclosures sometimes will cause you to lose clients, and that's what's difficult about making these disclosures. But if you don't make these disclosures, the client's not served well, and you're not served well later on if there comes a dispute between the clients. By the way, the other red flag, two red flags, two people come in your office, you got to start thinking about this stuff. Or if somebody's paying the fee other than the client, you got to start thinking about this stuff. Those two things, when they happen up front, quick, need you to make you go look at 106 and 107 at the beginning of a representation. After making the determinations required by A1 and A2, and as soon as reasonably practical after making the disclosures required by A3, the lawyer obtains each client's informed consent confirmed in writing to the representation. So the idea is that you're going to have to go through, if you have two clients in the same matter, three clients, 10 clients, whatever it is. Now, plaintiff's lawyers are going to say, "Yeah, but I got these cases where there's 700 clients. It's going to be tough. You're going to have to meet your clients. A lot of people are not going to like this. When we get to aggregate settlements, they're not going to like it either, because you're going to have to meet your clients again. So representing hundreds of clients in the same lawsuit is going to cause a change in the forms, a change in the way that you talk to them, a change in the relationship. Now, that's going to sound like it's plaintiff versus defendant, lawyers, and it's going to sound like plaintiff versus insurance companies, and all of that is melded into this discussion and through the compromises that we've come through. But we need to have a way in which the clients understand what they're getting into before they get into it, and not having explained to them after the difficulty has already arisen. So I think these are good changes, and I think that it will protect the public and it will protect the lawyer, even though it's going to take us more work. All right, 108. A lawyer shall not enter into a business transaction with a client other than the standard commercial transaction between the lawyer and the client for products or services that the client generally markets to others. Now, what I'm going to say about Ken and Peterson is that she really knows how to say one thing, and that is, "Why, Ken, that's not right." When we go through these, that really, and this is the one she really nailed me on, because I was real proud of that addition that Ken read there, and then she pointed out to me it was already in another part of the rule later on. So it's not nearly as good an addition. We've changed it from a definition into actually part of it, and that's other commercial, it's commercial transactions. You do not have to follow Rule 108 in dealing with your client if you are dealing with them in what is their normal commercial transaction. So when you go down to buy a car from your client that you're defending in some other matter, you don't have to deal with them in a fiduciary relationship. If it's a standard commercial transaction, you can deal with them in an arm's length transaction. What that happens to be, and by the way, don't represent your dentist, because the dentist waits until they get that stuff in your mouth and then they start asking you questions. And so not only are you talking to your client, you're intelligible, unintelligible, and he can't tell what you're saying. But you can, however, enter into one of these with a non-commercial transaction. Now, this is where you're buying stock in the new company. This is where you're going to be part of a limited partner in a real estate transaction. This is any time that you enter into a business transaction with a client. The lawyer reasonably believes that the terms of the transaction between the lawyer and the client are fair and reasonable to the client. All right? Now, we're trying to create a situation where you can do business with the client here without all of the fiduciary duties when dealing with your client, because that makes the situation pretty hard for you to protect yourself. So this is the way to do it. But you have to follow this part of it, that it's fair and reasonable to the client. And you'll be tested on that. Now, you're tested on that now, so don't worry about it. But you have to understand that it has to be fair and reasonable. And you have to, if known to the lawyer and not known to the client, are fully disclosed in a manner that can reasonably be understood. If you know something about this deal that the client doesn't know, that impacts your decision to get into it, but the other, your client doesn't know about it, you can't do it under 108 unless you inform the client of the stuff you know. And the test is you know it and they don't, and you need to tell them. And the lawyer advises the client of the desirability of seeking and gives the client a reasonable opportunity to seek the advice of the independent counsel on the transaction. Now, recognize the compromise that's in that. It could require you that they have to go to another lawyer, and it has to be signed off on by the other lawyer. This does not require that. This simply requires you to advise them that it might be their best interest to get another opinion from a lawyer, and then you have to give them a reasonable time. So if you're going to buy stock in your client's new company, don't sign the deal the day that it first comes up. Work out the details, give it to them, and then let a period of time lapse in which they would have a reasonable opportunity to seek another opinion if they want to. They don't have to, and you don't have to tell them that they have to. Now, that's a middle ground between the things that we could have put in there as to what you have to do, and that's one that was in the old rules and some rules, and I think it's a good place for the compromise to come down. The client provides informed consent, confirmed in writing, signed by the client, to the material terms of the transaction and the lawyer's role in the transaction, including whether the lawyer is representing the client in the transaction. Two concepts there. One, you got to get it signed off on for this. You can't go into business with your client without getting the client's signature. And then secondly, you got to tell them whether you're representing them in the deal. Because the number of times that grievances get filed or malpractice cases get filed because the deal goes sour and the client gets the short end of the stick, the client's testimony is almost always, well, I thought you were representing me in this deal too, and you didn't look out for me. You didn't fulfill your fiduciary duty to me. So at the time you decide to go into business with the client under 108, you have to put it in writing to them, I either am or I'm not representing you in this deal. You can go either way. But if you're not planning on representing them and you don't want to look out for their best interest in this deal, then you need to put in there, I am not your lawyer for this deal. And that has to be part of the stuff going in. That protects the client. It also protects the lawyer if he does this down the line. This one is as complicated as it gets, and there's not any good answers, but this is the best we know how to do. The current one has a lot of the same problems. Except as otherwise authorized by law, and that's important. A lawyer who represents two or more clients shall not make an aggregate settlement of the claims of or against that lawyer's clients, or in a criminal case, an aggregate agreement to guilty or nolo contendere pleas, unless the lawyer obtains informed consent of each client confirmed in writing. Aggregate settlements have been a problem throughout. Now, the reason the first sentence is important is that I've always been uncomfortable about the fact that you get a class certification, and once you get a class certification, does that take you out of 108? And it really isn't anything that says it does. So the first sentence in here is to say, except as otherwise authorized by law. So if you are a plaintiff lawyer and you get a class certification, you can then do what the court tells you to do about settling the case, and you don't necessarily have to comply with 108. You are then governed by the law that the judge sets down as to how you deal with class action. I think that's a very good change. Then the lawyer obtains the consent of each client confirmed in writing. And a number of cases that I've been defended on where there were hundreds of plaintiffs in a case, and then all of a sudden we come to some sort of settlement, and the plaintiff says, just write us a check for it, we'll figure out how to divvy it up. That wasn't right under the old rule, and we're now trying to create some ways in which you can get the thing settled, but recognize that aggregate settlements are a problem. And the test for whether or not it's really an aggregate settlement is not whether or not you got two clients. For example, if you are representing a husband and wife in some sort of deal, and they both collect money, and if you give them a check made out to both of them, you're not involved in 108. That's not an aggregate settlement because the lawyer's not deciding how to divide the money between the clients. It is that division of money between the clients that gives rise to the aggregate settlement problem. Now, after advising the clients the total amount of the settlement or result of the agreement, the existence and nature of the material claims, defenses, or pleas, the nature and extent of each client's participation in the settlement agreement, whether by contribution, payment, share of receipts, or resolution of criminal charges, the total fees, costs, and expenses to be paid to the lawyer from the proceeds by an opposing party or parties, and the method by which the costs and expenses are to be apportioned to each client. Now, that's a lot of stuff to go to, but if you're planning on representing 100 people, you just need to get ready to go through lots of stuff. And they need to know some of this stuff up front. And so this is the list of stuff that you can do and get out from under 108, in a sense, if you do all of this stuff up front and sign them up that way. Now, believe me, I handled one where there were 700 plaintiffs and they were after this company down in South Texas, and we finally reached a settlement, and they said, just give me the check. And I said, no, we're not going to do that. Here's what I'm going to make you do if you want to get the money. And I put them through a bunch of hoops. You have to give me an individual offer from each individual plaintiff for the amount that they want. We have to get the judge to approve the matrix that we're using to decide who gets what and what we're going to explain to them about the cause of action. We're going to have at least three fairness hearings. Oh, they hated my guts. We went through it. It took them a year after the time that we had settled it to come up with that. 6 weeks after the case was settled and the money was dispersed, another plaintiff's lawyers ran 100 of those clients and filed suit against the plaintiff's lawyers alleging an aggregate settlement because they said, you know, you violated 108. I changed from being the biggest villain in the Western Hemisphere to their king. They came and kissed the ring and said it was wonderful, and then I would go into court and testify, this is what we did, and the judge said, that's fine, there's no problem. And so the lawsuit went away. If we hadn't done all that stuff, though, there would have been litigation about that for years, about whether or not it was an aggregate settlement and what did they do, and it just would have been terrible. This is a way to handle 100, 700, however many plaintiffs you got. The big thing in there, remember, is this case can't be settled until Mrs. Jones knows what Mrs. Smith is getting out of the settlement. That is the key to complying with this rule and a successful settlement when you've got multiple plaintiffs. Don't settle the case when one client doesn't know how much the other client is getting, because when they talk about it in the grocery store next week, one of them is going to be hacked off. And that's what starts all the litigation in post-aggregate settlement cases. So, this is a way to settle safely, and to comply with this rule will get you past what the aggregate settlement problems are. Make an agreement with a client that requires a dispute between the lawyer and the client to be referred to binding arbitration. Now, we've been fighting about this for, 10 years, 20 years? And we've changed our position. Everybody has, you know. Everybody thought arbitration was the answer. Excess costs at the courthouse, and so we were putting them in. There were years in Texas, remember, when you couldn't enter into an arbitration agreement unless you had all the lawyers sign the arbitration agreement. And, I mean, it was just almost, it had to be in, what was it, 10-point, you know, the arbitration clause. I mean, the courts were very anti-arbitration. Then the public interest came around. We thought, well, the courthouse is too expensive. You know, we're going to do all this stuff and go over there. And so a bunch of people got behind arbitration, and it became the thing. It got put into all kinds of contracts. Then you go through a number of arbitrations and you think, well, this is not any faster, this is not any cheaper, this is not any more fun, and I can't feel that son of a gun. And so all of a sudden the bar itself started turning around on whether or not you're going to have arbitration. So I think I've been on both sides of this argument at least twice, you know, in the last 20 years. But the problem is, it has always seemed unseemly to me, this is just me talking, for me to say to a client, yeah, I'll take you to the courthouse, I can represent you, this is the justice system, the jury's the finest system we've ever had, and you need to be able to go in there, and you ought to be proud to be an American because the Constitution guarantees you trial by jury. But if we have a dispute with each other, we're not going over there. Now, that just sort of smelled a little bit to me. So there was a big fight about whether or not lawyers can put arbitration clauses in their fee agreements. And a lot of people are in favor of it, and a lot of people are against it. So it comes out with, you can have an arbitration agreement about fees ethically. Now, whether or not the court's going to say you can do it legally or not, that's another question. But ethically, you can make an agreement if the client is represented by independent legal counsel in making the agreement, or the lawyer discloses to the client in a manner that can be reasonably understood by the client the scope of the issues to be arbitrated, the fact that the client will waive a trial before a judge or a jury on these issues, and that the rights of appeal may be limited. Now, there are lots of other sources which have three or four other things that you probably should disclose to a client before making them subject to an arbitration agreement. But this is a pared-down list, and there are complaints from people because not everything is in there. But the idea is that at some point, if you put enough things in there that you have to disclose that sound awful, nobody will take arbitration. So I promise you, if you give me enough things to disclose to the client, I'll talk to every one of my clients out and go sign up with an arbitration agreement. So this is a shorter list than some people recommend of things you have to disclose that allows you to go forward with an arbitration agreement between you and the client. And I think it's an okay compromise. All compromises are just okay. All right, 109. Unless the former client provides informed consent confirmed in writing, a lawyer who personally has formally represented a client in a matter shall not thereafter represent another person in the same or substantially related matter in which that person's interests are materially adverse to the interests of the former client. This is the old language of substantially related, but there's an added test onto the end of it that's going to change things a little. Why leave one substantially related in 109 and we took it out of 106? 106, remember, is when they're coming in and you're going to be representing people and there are not a whole lot of disqualifications filed under 106. Under 109, if a lawyer sues you and used to represent you, the question of what you have to prove in order to get them disqualified, what you do with the confidential information that you've got, and it didn't seem seemly to make a client reveal the confidential information to the court in order to get the lawyer disqualified, because you sort of were letting the cat out of the bag. One of the things that substantially related does is there is a series of cases which say that there's an irrebuttable presumption of shared secrets and confidences, which means you can get them disqualified without having to give up the ghost of the good stuff you don't want them to know. That seems to me to be appropriate in a disqualification. Now, a legal malpractice case under that, that presumption's not there, and that presumption doesn't need to be there, and I argue, under 106, because that is a different situation where you're bringing them in up front, you're trying to decide if there's a conflict between them. It's not something that rises ex post facto in the sense that you get sued later on or you get a complaint because you took on a case against a former client. The addition about personal interest are materially adverse, there are disqualifications that take place because of technical violations, because you find that the two things are substantially related, but there wasn't any adversity involved in the situation. There wasn't any really reason to do the disqualification. And motions to disqualify under 109 are being used as tactical devices in cases when the client really doesn't care about the confidential information. It's just a good old thing to go over there and hammer the other side around with, and it gets filed lots and lots of times. We think that this is important to reduce the availability of a technical violation of substantially related that is really being just used as a tactic, and there isn't any real confidential information to be protected. And that will come up if they're not materially adverse to each other. It doesn't matter what the confidential information was because it's not going to be part of the lawsuit. So that's the reason it comes out of 109 and didn't come out of 106. You can argue a whole lot about this, about the change and what it's going to do, but I think this is another compromise that came where lots of people felt very strongly both ways. Unless the former client provides informed consent confirmed in writing, a lawyer who personally has formally represented a client or minor shall not thereafter represent a person in a manner adverse to the former client, which questions the validity of the lawyer's services or work product of the former client. You can't attack your own work. Chuck, I'm going to have to call and ask you. I've got a situation where I drafted the statute, which my client's being sued under, and I screwed it up when I drafted the statute.
You're liable.
I just don't know. No. The client's tickled to death the fact I screwed up. The question is, can I actually take advantage of my own mistakes? See, this is where you're attacking your work.
You will.
Regardless of what anybody says. But this is not much different from the other one, and that is if you draft a will, you can't later take on the beneficiary or the kid that got left out of the will to attack and say the will's void. If you drafted a prenuptial agreement, you can't then represent one party to the divorce to say the prenuptial is good. And so I think this works well. All right. Those are the ones that my attention span got me up to. Now, there's some others that I didn't think were going to be that controversial, but which have become controversial, and I'll try to cover those fairly quickly. How much time do I got left?
You have time to do that quickly.
All right. 1.13, sexual clients. What can I say? ABA has a rule. We now are proposing a rule. A lot of people say it's not strong enough. A lot of people say we shouldn't get it. The thing that irritates me is the people that tell me we shouldn't put it in there are family lawyers, and they caused the problem in the first place. but the sex with clients rule, particularly in family law situations where there's high emotions, we become a mental health provider just like the psychiatrist and the psychologist. And all the mental health care professions have had a no sex with clients rule, and we need to have one. And this one is a compromise between, but you can't imagine the discussions that went on about this rule. There are two new rules. Well, that's one of the new rules. There's another new rule that I'll cover, and then I'll quit, and that's prospective clients. As you know, attorney-client privilege stuff attaches to prospective clients so that if they come in and they try to hire you and they tell you a bunch of stuff, you can get conflicted out from taking that, any part of that litigation later on. 117 is a rule which sets up a way by which you can protect yourself from that and still give advice to the client, and I think it's a good addition. With that, I will stop, and we will talk about more of these if you have any questions about any of them or any of the others you want to talk about. Thank you.
So what we need is a question.
Well, I did have a question, but not yet to go up to the podium.
Or we're going to go through the green ones. I'll do the housekeeping right now and let you know the sequence here. If you want to speak right now, we're going to ask you to fill out a green card. We already have some. If it's a comment, it may just be listening, and that's good. But we'll listen to the comment. It'll go on the record. It'll get disseminated. If it's a question, then we'll try to be sure we have the right resource person in the room answer that question. And then once we exhaust the cards, it'll go to a room discussion on some of the issues. But right now, we're going to go through the green cards. You would stand up when I call your name. You go to the back microphone, tell us your name, tell us where you're from, and then direct us to the specific rule, because everybody in the room may want to turn to that rule. And Ray will have about 5 minutes going, so we be sure we get through that portion. And so just in the order that I've been handed the cards, the first speaker is Rich Robbins. How about that?
Well, okay.
Yeah. Just your name, where you're from, and what rule you're making inquiry of.
Rich Robbins from Houston, Texas. Can you hear me, sir? Okay. Okay, great. My biggest concern is with the fact that thank you very much. That we've heard it commented at the panel that there may not even be an attorney referendum. Is that correct? That's something I'm very concerned about.
No, there's not one ordered now, so we don't have a time and a date and what it would consist of. We do believe if this process goes through that after the board gives its recommendation to the Supreme Court, we would be waiting on the Supreme Court to tell us if they're going to make any other changes to the proposed amendments, and if so, ask for a referendum under what terms and conditions.
Okay. Now I'd like to move on to the proposed rule that will ban amorous relations. I'd like to bring up the example of Britney Spears. Let's analogize her to an attorney, if that's at all possible. She's in some hot water at the present time. She's being sued by a former bodyguard for having behaved inappropriately in a sexual sense. And she doesn't have video coverage of all that transpired or audio coverage. If she did, it would be on the internet and we'd all know about it. So she doesn't. And she's going to end up having to make a settlement if she's concerned about her reputation, which she may very well not be. But either way, imagine if you were an attorney and someone came up with a frivolous accusation after a settlement. And what client is ever satisfied with any settlement? I recently settled a matter of my own a few weeks ago, and I'm still regretting it. And I'm an attorney who had informed consent when I made that settlement. Okay, a lot of clients are going to look to be able to point their fingers at someone and take out their frustrations with their lack of satisfaction with the settlement. And unless an attorney has got audio coverage and video coverage of everything, which an attorney won't, then there's going to be a real disincentive to take on new clients' cases. As it stands, we're already complained about as being a very inaccessible profession. Is this really the road we want to go down? Let's think about Britney Spears, ladies, please. George Herbert Walker Bush from here in Houston said during the State of the Union address one time that he's annoyed by certain people who remind him of Puritans, who get upset because somewhere, somehow, somebody may be having too much fun. Well, I personally don't engage in amorous relations with clients. There are enough existing rules that make it imprudent to do so, but I don't want a flurry of false accusations coming against me and making me a lot less willing to take on more clients' cases. In moving along, we heard a comment about psychologists and psychiatrists. and how they have chosen to ban amorous relations with their own clients. Well, they receive a lot of Medicare and Medicaid funding, and if they're going to keep getting our tax dollars, they need to maintain a squeaky clean image. They can sedate clients. Even a psychologist can put someone on the couch and hypnotize them and put them to sleep. So, yeah, you've got to have a squeaky clean image you can do that. I'm not aware of too many attorneys who can do that. I mean, we did see, I guess in the movie Forrest Gump, we saw a very happy woman fall to the floor after she got a settlement check from Forrest Gump, but he wasn't an attorney. But otherwise, attorneys can't floor their clients. We can't sedate them. Do we really need this rule? And moving along, in litigation, it's inherently stressful, and people are always accusing us, when they're on the other side, of having pursued a frivolous endeavor. Sometimes your only real friend in an endeavor is your client. And if you didn't have an amorous relation beforehand and something does materialize, should that really be banned? Some attorneys are so busy, they don't have time for a social life. They don't want to go out and explain to someone why what they do for a living is actually important. That client is already persuaded. If it's consensual, then what's wrong with that? I don't engage in it, but I don't think that other people should be prohibited from doing it. I'm wondering, though, if we're going to see a duty, or at least an expectation by clients, emerge to plant a potential paramour on opposing counsel so that you can later try and get that counsel disbarred. I wouldn't put it past some people. I understand that my time is running out. I do ask, though, we see some academics and malpractice attorneys, or at least we see some academics advocating that this ban be imposed. But do we see them advocating that a ban be imposed with regards to amorous relations with students? No, we don't. We see most professions not even touching this kind of stuff with a 10-foot pole. Why should we? Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. You have a specific question on 113, or do you want to just call that a comment?
Well, I would call that a comment. My other question is...
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. If one is found to be in violation of one of these rules, does that mean they're also liable, I guess, negligence per se or malpractice per se because they violated a Texas bar rule?
We can answer that, I think.
Thank you.
And the answer to that is no. The preamble to the Texas disciplinary rules points out that these are for grievances. They're not for civil liability. And lots of judges, the most effective eliminating me from a trial as an expert witness was the judge who decided, okay, well, I could even talk about it, but you can't use any numbers. And it was like telling me I could testify with sitting on my hands, which I can't do that either. But I'm unable to talk about this stuff without talking about numbers, and so I really babbled up there for a while. You do not get an issue to a jury, did you violate Rule 1.19? It is not negligence per se. It is not something the jury has to decide after somebody testifies that there was a violation, and if the court allows it, there was a violation of the rule, and the jury has to decide if it is or is it not negligence to have done that. You go a long way toward winning a plaintiff's case if you can show a violation of the rules, but that's just the way it's been played out. These do not set specifically, the court says, standards for civil liability. Now, in response to 1.13, sex with clients, we're not trying to regulate conduct. We don't really care if there's a bunch of sex going on. We do not want, however, a lawyer who is having sexual relationship with a client that started after the attorney-client relationship was created giving advice to the paramour. It impacts the ability to give judgment. It is different. It is difficult. Lots of people in this field believe that 1.06 already keeps this from happening, that it's something that would infect your judgment, and therefore you ought not to take the case. And, of course, they're going to be swearing matches, but they're swearing matches now. A family lawyer called me up and said, by golly, boy, the other side's going to raise the specter of the lawyer having sex with his client in almost every case that we have in family law now if we adopt this. Well, of course, if you're having sex with a client right now in a divorce case, it's likely to come up even if this rule is not adopted. And if you're having sex with a client who's about to go in and participate in a family in a custody fight, you ought to be disbarred, because that certainly is going to affect the client's ability to keep their kids if they're having sex with the lawyer while the case is pending and while they're still married. So the he said, she said, or he said, or she said cases that may come up under this are going to be the same kind of swearing matches that can happen today. It is embarrassing to the ABA to have not had this rule. They think that the other professions think that we are really lacking because we haven't put this into it. There is strong pressure from various segments of the bar that we ought to have this in. I think it ought to be in there. I think it's a good rule. It's a compromise. It's not quite the same as the ABA's. It's certainly not the same as the rule that the task force first passed, and it's not the same that the state bar committee first passed. The court has kind of gone towards the ABA there, and I think it's something we ought to do. We're getting a lot of complaints about it not being strong enough. Because, see, let's say that you're representing a client and an amorous relationship shows up. Arguably, under the proposed rule, you simply move the case down the hall to another lawyer and he starts representing them. And a lot of people say that doesn't fix anything. In my mind, though, it does place in place a lawyer who is not having sex with the client to give an independent, objective sort of opinion to the client that when you're not personally involved with them. But I can certainly see a good argument being made that you ought not to be able to get out of this just by moving the case down the hall. So that's why this is a compromise between two very strongly held positions, and I think it's a good compromise.
Okay, the next speaker, Chuck, you're next.
And just I'm really just going to ask questions. You've got any other speakers, why don't you?
Okay. We'll do it that way. James, next. Yeah, and just to help you out, James, after you, we'll go to Michael. And if I'm reading the card right, everybody, if you want to look, we're on 105.
Right.
And James, tell us your name and where you're from.
Yeah, James Cargis with the City of Houston's City Attorney's Office, but I'm here on my own account. Just reading Rule 105-4D1, dealing with disclosure of confidential information. I just personally believe in a civilized society, we should not be sanctioning any bodily injury and making a distinction between what's serious and not serious. Financial injury can be remedied by money later on, but you know these rules are about morality and ethics, and sanctioning some form of bodily injury, I don't think is appropriate. But let's get beyond the moral issue. The rule really doesn't serve the public, since some injury is tolerated. It doesn't really serve the profession either, because there's no bright line as to did the lawyer make the right judgment or not, because you will always be judged with hindsight in 2020. That, you know, a taser is not supposed to be a violent thing. Well, sometimes tasers do kill people. And you know, I think it's just kind of a dangerous place to be in. I'm not sure what the ABA rule is, so I can't speak to the third section of the pie. But I just want to make a comment for the record. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we're not sanctioning the less than substantial bodily injury. We are trying to find a place where the lawyer has affirmative obligation. Remember, this one says you have to do it. You have to disclose attorney-client privilege information. You have to draw the line somewhere because we do believe the attorney-client representation. And goodness, we had a case in Austin that was just awful where there was a baby that had been kidnapped and nobody knew if the baby was alive or not. And the poor lawyer that was representing the alleged kidnapper was just being pounded on by everybody because everybody knew that the client had given to the lawyer a piece of paper which presumed was a map as to where the baby was. And that young lawyer had to decide whether or not she had an obligation to turn it over or not, attorney-client privilege. And the question turned on if the baby's still alive, then there's an ongoing crime. If the baby's dead, there is no ongoing crime. And it changed the obligation depending upon what she knew about the whereabouts of the baby and when and whether or not the baby was alive or not. That's a horrible situation, but you can see that attorney-client privilege questions get tough down the line. And this line is not, in other words, we will publicly say you ought not to ever beat up a judge. Won't we? And just as when does the lawyer have the affirmative duty to breach the attorney-client privilege and to turn his client in? And that's for a future substantial bodily injury. And that's a compromise between the value of the attorney-client privilege and the value of the of trying to protect any kind of injury to people in the future.
What happened in that story?
No, did not. Chuck, you remember?
So what was the question?
About what happened to the story about the kidnapping and the map. Did I believe that the baby was dead and she did not reveal it and took a beating for it.
Yeah, that's right.
And then, of course, everybody said, well, you know where the dead body is. You ought to turn that over. Well, that is information received as a result of the attorney-client privilege. Just recognize how horrible that is on everybody. So attorney-client privilege stuff is valuable because if we want, and you all know this, if we want the clients to tell us the stuff that we can help them keep from doing bad things, we need to know what it is they're thinking about doing. And if they think that there is a way that the prosecutors or somebody down the line can get that information from us, they're not going to tell their lawyers, and therefore they don't get good advice. And so it's a swearing match.
Michael, do you wish to speak? It's not clear on the card that I've been given. All right.
Is that Esmeyer?
Yes, sir. Yes. It'll help us if you get over. Mike, I know it's hard to get through.
I think the only question that I have is, I was always taught that if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Tell you what, we don't want to respond, give us your name and where you're from, and then ask.
Mike Esmeyer, Esmeyer Critico, Wayne. And I've been practicing for a minute or two. But it seems like, and I know, because I got here because I've been told that we were doing significant changes, but it seems like the changes we've made are the rules that we've really been running by for the last 15, 20 years. Even the sex with your client. Most lawyers would tell you having sex with your client is probably going to get you in a lot of trouble one way or the other, either civilly or criminally. So the question that my firm had was, why are we doing this now? Other than the sex with the client, because even though we believe that that's something that we shouldn't do, it wasn't in our rules, but just because it's not in the Ten Commandments doesn't mean that it's not something that we shouldn't do. So that's the only question that I had, is why now?
Well, what started the process was the ABA adopted a new set. And a lot of feeling that, and I think it probably was Justice Phillips when he was Chief Justice, would go to the Chief Justice meeting, and there was lots of talk about the fact we've got to get some uniformity. The interstate practice is just coming, and there needs to be what's ethical in one state is ethical in another state. So there was a lot of pressure going for that. The second change is that technology really changes the way some of these things work. So there needs to be some changes made to the rules that conform what is our current practice to the DRs. And that's the sort of thing like being able to confirm something through by email and get it back and have it confirmed. There need to be some changes in order to recognize technological changes. And the third thing is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Well, the question is it broke? There are areas where it is broke. Somebody told me the other day, why are you changing 106? There's not very many grievances filed under 106. Well, that may mean it's broke. Because there's a lot of conflicts of interest going on out there, and the system isn't catching them and isn't properly policing the folks who take on these kind of conflicts and don't try to get away with it. So the fact that there are not many grievances under it means that it probably needs to be tightened up. Then we've got a lot of grievances that get filed, like I say, that are technical grievances. And if you've ever been through one of those as a defendant in a grievance, and it's one of those things where you got popped for something that your client wasn't upset about at the time and then got, buyer's remorse later on and came back on it, we need to fix some of those so the lawyer can have a way to protect themselves up front. So like I say, there are lots of people who think they need to be changed to protect the public better than it is. There are those that say it need to be changed in order that the lawyer has a way to protect themselves from frivolous grievances and malpractice lawsuits. And there's a bunch of people that say what's ethical in Texas ought to be ethical in Colorado. Those are the three motivating factors as to why this process got started.
All right. We may get some more green cards, and we'll do that along the way. Kaylin, we'll pick them up in the back if you have one, so those are game the rest of the day. But keep the room going. Chuck, let's go to what questions you might have.
My name is Chuck Herring, and I'm a lawyer from Austin. And the last time Tom and I talked at length, you were cross-examining me that day, I believe it was.
I suspect that's about to happen now.
No, you're not going to cross-examine me, but that's there might be some cross-examination. No, but I do want to thank you for the extremely odd level of masochism you have exhibited in doing this enterprise, because it's you put in a ton of time. And I think, like most folks who do this a lot, I disagree with some of the rules. And some of the proposals are awful, and some of them are pretty good. I think Jim McCormick came up with the question of, well, if we're going to make every lawyer have to read 156 pages of rules and comments, and it's going to take 4 hours to do that, and it's $262 an hour, the State Bar says, is the average billable rate, and there are 85,000 lawyers, that's $90 million. And, you know, that's a lot of expense, systemic expense. But
what
did you all do...
that is to say we don't start this until everybody's read the old rule.
Well, yeah, you could make it $180 million. That's true. You could do that. Or you could spend a little more money on the disciplinary system, which, you know, the budget got slashed on if public enforcement was the goal. But anyway, was there any kind of cost-benefit analysis on any of the proposed rules? In other words, what's it going to do? And my background is I'm representing a large law firm that's doing a 50-state presence. And their problem is the one that you raised in part. These rules are different. I mean, you're changing the conflicts rules radically in Texas. And you're getting us out of step with what's going on in the ABA in some instances. And that means my large law firm clients are going to have a section of the firm manual that's Texas only. And a section that's someplace else, and Travis Sales Parking comes in from New York, is going to, you know, have to make sure that client was obtained, perhaps, depending on the choice of law issues, the way we have to in Texas now. Was there any kind of cost-benefit conducted?
Well, there's two parts to that. I don't think we did any cost-benefit analysis of the cost of the process, like you mentioned, about getting it adopted. In every one of these rules, there's a cost-benefit analysis in which we argue with each other about what is going to be the economic effect of this change, and is it worth that for the change based upon what lawyers are going to have to learn in the future. So yes and no. Prospectively, we looked at it. As far as the cost of the current process, we didn't, or I didn't.
And there's no report that estimates anything like that, I assume. Let me ask you just, if I can, a few questions. The definition of affiliated has gotten a lot of attention because that's the linchpin for imputed disqualification of these rules. It shows up again and again and again through these rules. Is affiliated, and then you have comments on affiliated, is affiliated going to catch contract lawyers? Is it going to catch the outsourced lawyers that large corporations are using? If they have full access to the confidential information of the law firm with respect to that client?
Yes.
The particular client?
Yeah.
All right.
I'll cite you to the place. And Chuck, as you know, when we buy liability insurance, we have this same issue come up all the time as to who's going to be insured under the policy. Is it a contract lawyer? Is it somebody who, you know, an intern, somebody who's a law student who's there? So the pressure on this one is we don't have a good system right now for handling grievances or questions where somebody like that who's involved in it, because we don't have a good way of defining it. This, I think, does a better job of scoping in all and scraping in all those people and make them subject to rules.
So the law firms, in effect, need to err on the side of inclusiveness and run their conflicts search on every contract lawyer?
Yeah, because it says the lawyer is affiliated with the firm if either the lawyer or the lawyer's professional entity has any other relationship with that firm, regardless of the title given it, that provides the lawyer with access to the confidence of the firm's clients that is comparable to that typically afforded to lawyers in Category 1.
Of course, you could argue that a contract lawyer may not have comparable access, but you would say, apparently so, and so that lawyer, a service, needs to be included in your conflict service.
Well, you
right?
See, it's going to come down to the fact of what is the confidence. And so you, if I mean, there's going to be a secret, let's say. And if the contract lawyer doesn't have any full access to the file, you can be argued that they're not covered by this. But if they have access to that secret of the same level that a partner in the firm did or somebody, well, then they would be covered by that. So you can see we're going to...
Of course, you're assuming that the conflict will be issue-specific or secret-specific.
Well,
And you've left in substantial relationship under 109.
That's right. But if you bring in contract lawyers, it's going to almost evolve into a specific fact issue as to whether the contract lawyer knew any of the confidences about that or not.
No, under 109, it'd come down to substantial relationship, wouldn't it?
Well, remember we added that material step to it, so you'd still test it. But I will tell you that this is an attempt to try to scoop all the different various relationships into the confidentiality responsibility. And that's going to cause a lot of problems, but that's one where you can say, Watkins, we're going to have to litigate and litigate and litigate. Yeah, but right now we're not able to do anything about the fact that contract lawyers or of counsel lawyers and all these other names that we put on them, we don't know what to do with them.
Ray, you're going to call time on me there. I mean, he's been filibustering here. All right, one more question.
You're shocked by that?
One more question. No. I've opposed you, too. I know how it works. 104, and this is just a general, I'll ask a general question, but I'll tie it to 104. You have omitted the prohibition that's in the ABA model rules against unreasonable expenses. So we have no prohibition against unreasonable expenses. And then, indeed, in Rule 1.13, your sex with clients rules, you've prohibited exchanging sex for fees where you don't make expenses. So does that mean you can run up unreasonable expenses and then get a lot of sex for it?
Well, let the record reflect he winked.
Let the record reflect he paused.
No, we have. I've been getting a bunch of court reporter bills lately, and I figured the only way we can pay these is for sex.
Well, and here's my concern publicly is that your whole, I mean, that's already been, you know, op-edited against here in Houston, and it makes us look like we don't want to be in step with the rest of the country. It's okay to charge unreasonable expenses, and that's my concern. You've got that same issue that flows through a number of these rules, and it's a balance you have to make between how much we're going to get trashed as a profession or not. But that one in particular seems to me egregious to say it's okay for Texas lawyers, nobody else in the country, but it's okay for Texas lawyers to charge unreasonable expenses. And I've seen, and you and I both seen egregious violations of expenses. I've had a guy who charged his season tickets to the UT football game for the client, and they're good tickets, but the client didn't want to pay. A guy who charged liquor during trial, a lot of liquor every night, and then lost the trial inadvisably and put it on his bill. So there are unreasonable expenses that may not be enough to total something to justify a lawsuit, but can make us look really, really bad as a profession.
Yeah, and I think we need to look at that. I mean, it is, of course, not the intent of any of the drafters to say we can have unreasonable expenses. It's a question of whether or not we made a mistake by leaving the words out. In other words, we should have stuck it in after that. On the other hand, I don't know what I'm going to say about this, because the point is well taken that we don't want to authorize unreasonable expenses, so we ought to look at this again.
All right. One more?
Yeah.
All right. 106 does not have a prohibition against conflicted representation. It has some specific items, but you left out the language from Model Rule 1.7a, which says thou shalt not undertake conflicted representation.
Chuck's point there is that the 106 sets up and says this is a conflict of interest, and then it says you may handle a conflict of interest if you do this, 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 and this. And his point has been that it doesn't say, by the way, you can't handle it in the other situations. And so,
which the ABA rule does say.
Yeah.
And you deleted that language.
So whether we say you can only handle a conflict of interest if, or something that puts the prohibition explicitly in there rather than impliedly like it is now.
Right.
And I'm going to, just as a reference, Pat Chamblin is chair of the Standing Committee for the State Bar Disciplinary Rules. They are still working on this. The DCAP Committee for the State Bar, which is what's bringing the report to the board meeting in October, on October 1st, they have gone straight to that and have already suggested a prohibition, shall not unless. So that's in play.
I was going to ask Harry how he felt about the sex with clients, because if he doesn't answer it right, he can't go home.
No. My wife was one of the email signatories on that, so I have no comment on that.
Jenny is one who feels that it is not strong enough. She feels very strongly that it's not strong enough.
That's evident. Let me ask you one last question. 107, which is a rule the ABA doesn't have. You're getting rid of our intermediary rule, which is our current 107. ABA got rid of its 107 and put a few of the provisions of it in the comments to its rule 2.2. You got four reasonable beliefs whenever anybody wants to represent two clients, no matter transactional or litigation. You got four reasonable beliefs and essentially four disclosures, four Miranda warnings you got to give them. 106, the general conflict of interest rule, requires that before I can get informed consent, I have to tell my client all material risks and all reasonably available alternatives. That's to get just general 106 consent to conflicted representation. The four Miranda warnings under 107, if they're not material risks, why are we requiring people to say them? If they are material risks, aren't they already required under 106?
Yeah. The question is, if you comply with 106, you shouldn't have to comply with 107 because they overlap. And they do overlap. But very strong part of both committees wanted them to make them explicit in 107. And so, and then not only that, we put the referral back and forth between the two rules. So,
no other state in the country has that. You've got to do both rules. All right. Also, I could go on, but I'll stop there if you've got other questioners. Mr. President.
Sure. Ken Peterson is going to respond to one of the questions you raised.
Right.
I just want to speak to 1.06 for a moment, because you mentioned that it doesn't have an explicit prohibition in it and that the ABA does have that. The ABA rule is 1.7, and it actually contains the same language that is arguably problematic in 1.06 now. And just as a matter of background, that's why the language was put into the rule, and I think, everybody who's looked at it in hindsight, the DCAP committee has recommended that an explicit prohibition be put into the rule. And I suspect that will go up to the court from the board of directors as well.
All right. The room's open for questions. And if you don't mind, we're going to be sure to use the mic, so we may do a little bit back and forth.
I'm Jimmy Brill. I'm a solo practitioner in Houston. I have three issues. 1.04 says that it's a violation if a reasonable lawyer would be left with the firm belief that the fee is excessive. What about all the lawyers that are filing fees in the federal court claiming $10 million and the judge cuts them down to six? You have a reasonable lawyer who has now found that they've charged an excessive fee. Haven't collected it, charged it. Is that going to subject the lawyer to discipline? I got you.
I got two more.
Now, remember, there's a difference between a lawyer charging the client a fee and what a federal court fee shifts. I know, but see, the judge really isn't deciding what a reasonable fee is, quote unquote. The judge is deciding how much of a reasonable fee he's going to make one party pay for the other side, or going to approve a fee as it comes out of the a common fund in any kind of settlement like that. And so there's nothing here, as far as I can tell, that says that once a judge has decided what the fee ought to be, that that's in any way binding on a grievance committee or on a jury later on.
I want you to know I don't think it should either.
Yeah, I agree. I've got one judge that's a good friend of mine that I won't go in his court on a fee application because he always says, I never charged more than $100 an hour when I was practicing, and I'm three times the lawyer you are, Watkins.
I'm on 105 now. Let me give you a hypothetical. I'm a solo practitioner. Let's assume that your firm would take me on in some basis. You're going to have to ask me who I represent. You're going to have to ask me what I do for them. You're going to have some idea about how much money I can get from them. And why, when I tell you that, is that not a breach of confidential information? And why isn't it happening every day with the white-collar migrant workers who we call lawyers who move from firm to firm.
And it is happening every day. I mean, I don't deny that. Every time a merger takes place, every time a lateral moves from one firm to another, it is really difficult to deal with the fact that he's got to give up a whole bunch of confidential, both parties have to give up a whole bunch of confidential information to find out if the merger is going to work. So I don't think we fixed that problem.
I don't think you have either. I think it's subject to great problems. And here's why I'm asking all this. I've spent a lot of time worrying about dealing with the death of a solo practitioner and sale of a practice and that sort of thing. And Barb has said, every time somebody calls up to the practice management section and said, what do I do? My lawyer husband has died. My lawyer wife has died. My boss has died. What do I do? Since I have written on that, I get all those questions, and I don't have any of the answers. And so the bar says, couldn't you write a procedure to do that? Well, you can't write a procedure that gives you a black-letter answer if the black-letter in the DR says you can't do that. But I promise you it's being done every single day.
Well, and every time I get one of those calls, I answer. I have an answer. Call Jimmy Brill.
I guess that in the land of the blind, the man with one eye is the king.
And I'm not trying to cure my blindness. I'm just trying to get off the phone.
Here's my last one. Since we want uniformity throughout America, the ABA Rule 1.17 says you may sell a law practice if you do so and so and so and so. Our committee wouldn't take that on. We got the quick answer that clients are not commodities, cannot be bought and sold. Call for a vote. I was the only one to raise my hand in favor of that, and so here's my second chance. But since we're trying to be uniformity, why wasn't that considered?
For exactly the same reason of the politics that you're talking about there, is it, the reaction from the task force about selling was strong. No, can't do that. That's not right. There you go.
Well, there are only 8 states that don't permit it.
That's right.
Thank you. Texas used to be its own country. Could be again, and with the national debt being what it is and not even reflecting Social Security outlays and that sort of thing, I think this discussion is going to become more realistic as time progresses. And yet we're hearing that we should change our rules and compromise our profession so we can have uniformity with other states. But even in the meantime, aren't we part of a federalist nation where each state gets to more or less achieve its own individual identity for its own economic benefits? Texas creates more jobs than any other state. We don't have this regulation that some other states might, or that some other professions might. And do we really want to be that conformist?
Rich, I suspect that you and I shouldn't discuss politics.
How about the 10th Amendment to the Constitution? The 10th Amendment?
The problem is state lines in the legal profession are pressured by multi-state firms. And so whether you talk about a federalist system or whether you talk about 50 individual nations, it doesn't solve the problem of multi-state practices. And so the question always comes up, and there's a case, by the way, that I just saw a blurb on yesterday where some judge revoked a pro hoc vici because conduct occurred in the home state that was not violative of the DRs in his home state. What he did in his home state was not unethical. But the judge felt that it was unethical if he'd done it in the state where the lawsuit's pending, and he kicked him out. And it's going up, and everybody's trying to look at that, because when you start talking about conflicts of regulation between where you do it and is it a violation then, there, you know, I go to Colorado and take depositions. Well, am I authorized to practice in Colorado? No, I'm not. Is taking up a deposition in a case the practice of law? Yeah. Am I engaging in the unauthorized practice of law? Probably. Why doesn't somebody do something about it? Well, thankfully for all of us, we never fund the unauthorized practice of law committees with very much money, so they don't get around to those kind of cases. But we have continual unauthorized practice by all of us when we go across these state lines. We got to do something about that eventually. And so the question of independent state versus a nationwide system is really under pressure based upon multi-state law.
Other questions?
You're saying that if you have a...
Oh, sorry. Help, just help,
okay. If you you have a case that's filed here in Texas and the witness is in Colorado and everybody goes up to Colorado to take that deposition, do you think that's the unauthorized practice of law?
I do it all the time. But you got to ask me. If you put me on the stand and put me under oath and you say, did you go to Colorado? Yes, sir. Did you take a deposition in Colorado? Yes. Is that the practice of law? Yes. Did you do the practice of law in Colorado? Yes. Do you have a Colorado license? No.
Okay, thank you. I just
want
to make sure.
By the way, I'm going to keep on doing that.
Questions? Come on. Let's see, anybody got anything?
I've got some more, but I don't want to monopolize questions.
We'll come back, but I mean, let's thank you for saying that. Here we go.
Tom Pickford. I'm with Hoover Slovacek here in Houston. Silly question on 1.04. What's the difference between firm belief and the former standard of a reasonable belief?
Well, the real difference is that the is it what you believe in? Now that's not the right way to say it. It is.
I believe all my fees are reasonable.
No, I understand that. And I have a number of clients who never saw an unreasonable fee. Remember that part of that was the old, unconscionability question. And all I can say is that when we were going to lower that standard below unconscionability, just saying that it was a reasonable belief wasn't enough. It had to be a firm belief. There's now, we're dancing on the head of a pin right there, you know. But it just, it's more than just a preponderance of the evidence, good faith belief. It's a firm belief. What that difference is, it's just different.
Maybe you should look into a standard that is already in existence.
Well, see, there is a reason that the standards that are already in existence mostly come out of malpractice cases rather than out of grievances. And there is still a feeling that there ought to be a standard a little bit higher to put your license at risk rather than have to pay money, in other words. And that's an approach, and it's a legitimate approach, but as you can see, if you take that approach, you start drawing some lines above other lines, and the line that was already drawn in civil liability was not a white line, and you had a hard time finding it. And now we're going to say, now it's a firm belief. Oh, well, that firm belief, that's different.
I have another question on 105, actually just a statement. I support the person who said that the word substantial in front of bodily harm, it should be removed. There's no reason for it. If you think they're likely to commit a criminal act that's going to result in any kind of bodily harm, then you need to disclose that.
And of course, that's a problem with the current rules. I mean,
I would agree with that.
And the question is, do we want to change them?
Thirdly, this business, I have a concern about proving up attorney fees to a judge and having that judge slice those babies in half and then having a client come back and sue me or file a grievance saying your fees were excessive. And I don't think there's a distinction in this rule that you're drawing.
Well, and there's not a distinction in the current rule. I mean, the problem exists today. We haven't fixed it. And I don't know. I'm not sure how to fix it because the federal judges that I know are going to set the fees the way they're going to set the fees, regardless of what we put in the rules. And it's not going to be as much money as I think I ought to be able to charge.
Well, I'll tell you, there are district court judges and there are county court judges who have never seen a fee they like.
Yeah.
And they will. If you're lucky, you only get half of them. So.
And remember, there is not a problem in fee shifting. If you're going to make the defendant pay, then it doesn't necessarily have to be all the fees. The real problem is when it is approving the fees that you're charging your own client, and the judge comes out and says, this is a reasonable fee, and it's half of what you're charging. There's a problem.
But if your client is entitled to recover all of the fees in that action, simple breach of contract, you're entitled to recover all the fees. You go in there and you prove those up to the judge, and the judge cuts them in half or worse, then you've got a lawyer, okay? I think our county court judges and our district court judges have got to be licensed attorneys in the state of Texas. You got a lawyer saying, I got to believe that's excessive. It's half, you charge twice what I'm awarding. And I think that presents a problem for the attorney.
It certainly does, right now.
To help answer one of the questions, Pat Chamblin is chair of the current Standing Committee on Disciplinary Rules. So she's got 104 still.
Right. I was just going to say, and my other people who were around at the time may remember this differently, but I believe that this language, firm belief or conviction that the fee is in excess of the reasonable fee, if I remember this correctly, we were trying to kind of change the standard and make it a more middle ground, as Tom was saying. And my recollection is that this language that was chosen is language that has previously been used, not in this go-round of the rules. And my recollection is that there may be a body of case authority that already exists addressing that standard. But I could be wrong about that, but I believe that's correct.
Now, let me share some pain with you. Criminal lawyers have a duty to put their clients on the stand. There's an affirmative duty in which, when the criminal lawyer, that if you know your client's about to present perjury, there's some stuff you're supposed to do. So what does the poor criminal lawyer who has a client who he knows is lying, but he wants to get on and testify? Can you let him do it? Well, we went round and round about that. And boy, what it comes out to be, the standard among the criminal lawyers that we've bawled about and that we've tried to protect here is that they are allowed, because of the criminal process, to put a witness, a client witness, on the stand if he wants to testify. But he has duties if he knows that the client is going to tell a lie. Not just reasonably, if he has formed a reasonable, good faith belief that the client is going to lie, he can still put him on the stand and let him testify. He has to know that he's going to lie. Now, you tell me how that distinction works out, and they give an example. In other words, the client's failed the polygraph test. There's two other witnesses that says it didn't happen that way, but the client wants to get on the stand and said, I didn't do it. The lawyer believes he did do it. Can he put him on the stand? Because he's subordinating perjury if he sticks him up there. All right? Now, what they tell me is, yes, you put him on, and unless you saw him do it or you really know, then you have to go ahead and let the client get on the stand and testify about it. And I said, well, that's great, because there's a line. Now, how am I going to find that line? Because the only way I'm going to find that line is to put some other lawyer on there to testify whether or not it was reasonable to believe that. And we don't have any way to test that they did know. All we can do is an objective standard of what a reasonable lawyer in that position would have believed under the same or similar circumstances. So we're really on a little narrow pin that really hurt me while we were standing up there. But that's where it comes out. You got to know, or you can put the client on the stand.
Your name?
My name is Bob Hensley, and I have a consumer law practice in Houston. I am not Jimmy Brill's criminal lawyer. That's somebody else. I was chairman of a grievance committee for 5 years in Houston. This is just a fun remark before I ask a question. On that committee was a very famous lawyer, a whole bunch of famous lawyers, but one in particular who was killed a year ago in an auto accident. He'll remain unnamed. And we were after the license of a particularly bad lawyer who was the poster child for ambulance-chasing lawyers. And we got his license because he deserved to lose his license. And the lawyer, the prominent lawyer I just mentioned without a name, resigned from our committee, got in bed with the lawyer without the license, became the license for that lawyer, and made $50 million off of it, proving that the grievance committee system can profit a lawyer under certain circumstances. My question relates to two things. Where do we find the answers to some of these questions online? Because I really feel like I'm in kindergarten in here today. And secondly, I get 20 or 30 lawsuits a month, and some of them are in Dallas and San Antonio and Austin, and I have to refer them to consumer lawyers in those cities. And my habit has been to split the advance retainer, which I work for. But I sent a couple of cases to a lawyer in Fort Worth a week ago. Each case was roughly $60,000, defense of $60,000 cases. And he lectured my staff that we could not ethically charge half of the $1,000 advance retainer. So I had my staff prepare a bill for the half, because we review the file and we talk to the client, and I spent a lot more than $500 on it. Does anybody have any response to whether that's ethical and moral and legal to charge that part of a advance retainer?
You stepped right into a real hot button in Texas. We were the laughing stock of all the other states for years and years and years, because our old 104, splitting fees between lawyers not in the same law firm, had three sections to it, whereas the ABA only had two sections. The first of the three sections was one, split based upon work done. Two, based upon joint responsibility for the file. And then in Texas it said, or three, it's a referral fee. Which means the two first ones were specifically put in there to prevent referral fees. And so it said, you know, we had two in there that said that we're going to really do something about these referral fees, and then we said you can do it. Now, the court fixed that in its own way when it adopted 104 the year, 2 years, 3 years, some time ago. The answer to your question is that if you are able to justify based on the hours, then that's a legitimate split of fees. And there are many lawyers who have referral fee arrangements with other lawyers, and then those lawyers are trying to come back on them and not pay them the referral fee based upon the amendments to 104. And I think the proper response to that is exactly that. I'm billing you for this based upon the work I did, and therefore I'm entitled to it. But there has to be a justification of the referral fee. We now do not allow naked referral fees.
Right.
And I'm not sure what effect 1.17 sex with clients is going to do with naked referral fees, and I don't know if they're connected or not. But at any rate, that's a change that is not involved in this set. In other words, there's nothing in these proposed amendments that does anything to the 104 rule that the Supreme Court adopted. It stays as it is, and that is... You must justify the time, or there has to be joint responsibility, and we're going to find out what joint responsibility means, because that's an open question.
And Bob, to answer your question on where to follow this piece of paper, the texasbar.com/ethics, is that I would go there first. That will get you the links to the summary of all nine cities, the actual transcript that answers the questions, all nine cities. That's the place to go.
So, Bob, if there are answers, they're there.
Richard, you'll pardon me. There's a man right behind you that had asked a question.
Yeah. Thank you. My name is Harless Bimpel. I'm a solo practitioner here in Houston. My area of practice is environmental law, solo. And I'm going to address something that hadn't been discussed before. Is that appropriate?
Sure.
In this way, I'm indebted to Mr. Herring for two things. One is correctly spelling my first name. Having heard it once, I think that's the first time in 70 or so years that it happened.
Wow.
Thank you. And the other was calling to my attention Rule 30.105, maintaining impartiality of a tribunal, and in particular the proposed deletion of some definitional type material, which in one part says matters pending before a particular tribunal, either when that entity has been selected to determine the matter or when it's reasonably foreseeable that that entity will be so selected. My comments are, if you'll indulge me, going to be something like thinking out loud, but and they're certainly limited to my practice area. An environmental regulation of an activity in Texas that, for example, has to be permitted or enforced against, that regulation can be by one of two entities, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, which is headed up by three commissioners appointed by the governor. The other possibility is the Environmental Protection Agency, usually through the regional office in Dallas, the head of which is appointed by the sitting president. Either that regional administrator or the three TCEQ commissioners can be the tribunal, and usually are almost certainly the tribunal in the final analysis. Quickly, I'll try to be quick. Let's look at the Texas permitting situation. And I, if you'll indulge me in suspicion, I suspect this came about, influenced somewhat by a hypothetical situation where someone wants to build a coal-fired power plant, and it has to be permitted under the Texas Health and Safety Code, and the three commissioners, if there's a contest, and there almost certainly will be a vigorous contest of those kinds of facilities, the three commissioners will wind up making the ultimate decision on whether or not to issue a permit and what its conditions will be. Before it gets to the commissioners, this permit process will go through the staff of the TCEQ working under the executive director, but not directly for the three commissioners. If the executive director proposes to issue the permit and it's contested, it will in all likely go to the State Office of Appeals and Hearings before an administrative law judge who will make a recommendation to the three commissioners. And finally, after this months, maybe years-long process, the three commissioners will make a decision. But at the beginning, it is almost a certainty that that's what's going to happen. My initial reaction to this proposed change is I'm pretty sure, one, opposition, for a bunch of reasons, having to do primarily with the idea that up front, long before the decisions to be made, the applicant knows who the decision makers are going to be. Under this proposed change, it appears that the advocates for the applicants can go to those three commissioners individually, to be sure, not as a group, but individually, and advocate the issuance of that permit. That has a bunch of fairness issues, I think, dealing mostly with access, and thank you for the time. Just for starters, if this is before the commissioners in Austin, if you don't live in Austin, you're at a disadvantage. If you don't practice in Austin, if your client is in El Paso and can't afford for you to go and make that same advocacy, he's at a disadvantage. And similarly, make similar arguments in stuff like the EPA position in Dallas. Again, I think I would be opposed to this. Having to do in part with just the complexities of administrative law and the way this one little area of the law works.
Yeah, well, you put your finger right on a huge issue between one area of practice and most of the other people. This is a serious issue, and we need to really take a look at it. But for years and years and years, everybody thought you could go over to the agency and talk to the people. The PEC came out with an opinion, and the PEC narrowed what some folks thought was the permissible ex parte communication with the people there. The administrative section, a lot of administrative lawyers started saying we need to do away with this. And the pressure came from them to take this definition out, which caused the PEC opinion. The access issue and it is really strong. I mean, people ought not to have the permit pre-decided before they get to go over and object to it, which is what the ex parte rule is trying to avoid. There is the same problem, however, that you have with judges. I can call up the judge, and if the judge answers the phone, I can say, you know, is next week a jury week? There's nothing wrong with that other than showing I'm pretty stupid for not knowing when the jury weeks are. But if I call up and the judge answers and I say, which of these jury weeks are you going to be the one trying the case, there's probably something wrong with that. So there are calls to the administrative office, particularly in Austin. If you want to get a permit to build a house in Austin, you've got to go through a whole bunch of stuff. And so the administrative lawyers make the case that they need to be able to go over there before they file their application and find out what the current standard is, who it is that's going to make them do this and make them do that and get it all done and get it filed. And that if we leave this in here, they're not going to be able to do that. Well, I think they're making too much of that, but that's their position. How do you draw a line between that and going out with your buddy, the commissioner, and saying, now, if I file this application, you're going to approve my subdivision, aren't you? Which ought not to happen. That's true ex parte bad stuff. So we've got really the public's interest to be protected by the rule, and we've got the ability of lawyers to be able to serve their clients by being able to get enough information out of the agency to file it and administratively complete. Some people have said that's the way it ought to read, that you could go over there and deal with staff up until the time that it's administratively complete, and then at that point you don't get to talk to them anymore. I don't know whether that would work or not, but there's lots of issues on either side of this, and you've nailed the one that is the most important, and that is, are we giving enough protection to the public if we let these people go over and visit with these folks ahead of time? And that's something we have to look at.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Rich has a question, but anybody else that hadn't asked a question yet want to ask one?
Rich. I'll be brief. I believe we have, 2 minutes left?
Yeah.
Okay. I'd like to ask, if that's okay, a question for a group that's not represented here right now, our children. Is there a country on earth that is more burdened by regulations and that is more expensive to do business in? I do my share of international business law, and I hear that question asked quite a lot. I've also been asked, what is our number one export? I'm prepared to argue that our number one export is jobs. And yet we've got a prosperous economy, don't we? Well, my response to that would be, please look at usdebtclock.org. Our $13 trillion national debt isn't even a drop in the bucket compared to what we really owe. Okay, so that's how we finance our so-called prosperity. How are we going to maintain that prosperity when the balloon finally deflates? How are our kids going to be able to operate in a country with so many regulations? Where else in the world is law a graduate degree like it is here in the United States? Would someone please tell me if there's another country like that? In other words, law is an undergraduate degree everywhere else. And when you graduate, you're able to practice law and help the economy. Companies are flocking to such countries to be able to do business. It's much less costly to do so. Is that the legacy we want to leave for our kids? Well, if it is it also the legacy we want to leave to Social Security recipients who are not going to be able to collect because there's not going to be enough economic growth to sustain all the promises that have made to them, that we have made to them? So I'm just asking, before we make any more changes to regulations, we keep this sort of stuff in mind, please, for our children's sake and for Social Security recipients' sake. Thank you.
Any other questions in the room?
I just want everybody to know I'm a lot more interested in Social Security stuff than I used to be.
I do want to make a note. Damon Edwards came in, one of your representatives to the board that will be looking at this on Friday, October 1st. And we need to say some thank yous. HBA with Kay, thank you for helping today, helping get the turnout, really. And also, I'm sorry about the fire, and I know you're going through everything with the volunteer lawyers program. And please, doing well. Is there anything you need of this group? You want this room to hear about the fire and things we can help with? Volunteer to take cases with volunteer legal program here. That being the case, please, between now and October 1st, contact your representatives. Go to the website. Contact the bar with any questions and comments that keep coming. We appreciate you being here today. Thank you. You'll bring your voice up.